You're listening to The Debrief on Katagala Media, first recorded on March 18, 2014. For Alethea, this is Chaitin Ye and Jonathan Lee. On 9 o'clock p.m. Tuesday night, Taiwan time, demonstrators outside the parliament in Taipei have stormed the building and occupied the parliament floor. Police were pushed out and shut outside the floor by a barricade of furniture. Right now, there are about 500 demonstrators, mostly students, inside the parliamentary floor, and about 1,000 more outside the gates of the parliament. Academics active in social movements such as Academia Sinica legal scholar Huang Guochang and independent candidate for Taipei Mayor Ke Wen-je have been on site. Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, current and former chairpersons Su Zhenchang, Tsai Ing-wen, Frank Shea, and other DPP legislators have also joined the sit-in, as well as Taiwan Solidarity Union members and other social and civic groups. We will be live-blogging the events unfolding in Taipei on our posts on katagalamedia.com.
On Monday, the Cross-Strait Services Trade Agreement has left the Internal Administration Committee and is now on the parliament floor for a vote. The agreement has been signed between China and Taiwan in June last year to open up sectors ranging from finance to food and medical services for each other's enterprises and labor. Amidst jostling at the committee hearing today, the committee chair, KMT legislator Zhang Qingzong, unilaterally announced in the corner, 3 minutes into the committee meeting, that the agreement has expired its three-month review period and is automatically deemed to have passed. According to Clause 61, the legislative procedural law, if a bill has an executive order, it has a three-month limit for debate by a parliamentary committee before it must be sent to the floor. However, according to Lai Zhongqiang, convener for the Democratic Front Against Cross-Strait Trade and Services Agreement, the agreement is definitely not an executive order because the counterparty in China is not a part of Taiwan's government. He also pointed out that past trade agreements, including WTO Accession and the recent New Zealand FTA, have all been reviewed and ratified by the parliament as laws and not executive orders. Longtime KMT advisor Hao Mingyi and National Taiwan University's Economics Department Chair Professor Zeng Xiuling have opposed the agreement, citing debilitating consequences for Taiwan's service sector and labor force, and a much stingier opening on China's side. The Ma Ying-jeou government has said that failing to ratify the agreement will damage Taiwan's international credibility and make joining the U.S.-entered Trans-Pacific Partnership trade pact difficult. Opposition are also critical of the undemocratic process with this agreement. Most of the public did not know about this agreement until the day before signing, and promptly demanded the parliament to review the agreement line by line before ratification. The parliament promised 16 committee hearings before deliberating on the merits, but the last hearing was only held 2 weeks ago, and the agreement has now passed without any debate. Independent polls last week by the Taiwan Indicator Survey Research showed that 73.7% of voters want the parliament to debate and vote on the agreement line by line, and only 10.2% believe it should be voted on as a whole. The poll also shows that within KMT supporters, 68.1% support a line-by-line deliberation, and 73.1% of those who support signing the agreement also support line-by-line deliberations. Opposition groups vow to fight tooth and nail until the end, and a crowd has already begun gathering outside the legislative floor for sit-in protests. Meanwhile, the executive yuan thanked Committee Chair Zhang for his hard work to pass the agreement.
On Sunday, the Crimea Autonomous Region of Ukraine voted in a referendum to declare independence as the Republic of Crimea, and according to Russian authorities, have signed and concluded an agreement to join the Russian Federation earlier today. The Sunday referendum reportedly had more than 80% turnout, and 96.7% voted for independence, with the understanding that it was a precursor to being annexed by Russia. According to CNN, Russian President Vladimir Putin said in an hour-long speech that the referendum was legitimate and that 96.7% is a pretty convincing figure. Ukraine, on its part, protested the referendum, with interim President Alexander Turchynov saying that Ukraine will do everything possible to solve the crisis diplomatically but will not accept outright annexation of its territory. The referendum was also not recognized by the United States and the European Union, both of which has imposed sanctions on Russian officials by freezing their assets abroad and banning their travel, hoping to bring them to a negotiating table. So far, Russia has been defiant of these sanctions. The ongoing crisis began when a three-month-long sit-in and demonstration in Ukraine's capital of Kiev broke out into live-fire violence, causing then-President Viktor Yanukovych to flee the country and a new interim government installed. The protest itself was sparked by Yanukovych's decision to back out of closer ties with the European Union and instead leaning closer to Russia. Since then, Russia had deployed its troops in the Crimea region, which is a peninsula on the Black Sea on Ukraine's southern coast, and home to an ethnically Russian majority. Russia claims that its troops were already stationed there in a Russian base, according to previous arrangements. While no casualties were reported, Russian and Ukrainian forces exchanged warning shots. Ukraine had only become an independent democratic republic since the fall of the Soviet Union, but within its borders, ethnic Ukrainians and Russians have intensified the conflict through partisan politics. Crimea itself was considered by many in Russia to have been given away to Ukraine by the Soviet Union in 1954 and should rightfully belong to Russia. Another Russian-led independence referendum was that of Mongolia's, which held such a referendum in 1945 to declare its status separate from the Republic of China, which is the same government that later fled to Taiwan. In that vote, 100% of the votes supported independence and a closer tie to Russia. Taiwan-based journalist J. Michael Cole points out in an op-ed for the National Interest magazine that Taiwan and China are both watching the Crimea situation closely, as it has many parallels to cross-strait relations, including a large trading partner that seeks to exert influence and annex Taiwan outright. Cole argues that the weak reactions from the United States and the EU sends a dangerous signal to China, giving it more confidence to be more aggressive. With the ongoing struggle over the trade agreement and services with China, and demonstrators storming and occupying the parliamentary floor, the situation in Taipei may be intensifying along the same route as Ukraine.
On Tuesday, the US Senate held a hearing on alternative healthcare systems around the world, with experts on healthcare in France, Canada, Denmark, and Taiwan testifying. The US recently overhauled its private healthcare system when the Affordable Care Act, also known derisively as Obamacare, was signed into law in March 2010. What originally began as a scheme to introduce universal public healthcare became a system mandating citizens to purchase private health insurance. The Affordable Care Act was bitterly fought over by both Republicans and Democrats, with Republican Senator Ted Cruz from Texas refusing to pass the budget unless provisions in the act were delayed, causing the U.S. government shutdown last year. In comparison, Taiwan has had a single-payer national healthcare system since 1995 and has generally been seen by other nations as a relatively successful model. Testifying on Taiwan's healthcare system was Dr. Ye Jingchuan, the founding CEO of Taiwan's Health Insurance Administration and a former Minister of Health in 2008. Dr. Ye testified that Taiwan's system has enjoyed high public support and satisfaction at 70-80%, and it provides efficient services at low cost through a single pool by competitive not-for-profit providers. According to Dr. Ye, there are no waiting lists other than a few prestigious hospitals, and while Taiwan's life expectancy is higher than the U.S.'s, Taiwan spends significantly less of what the U.S. spends on healthcare. Within Taiwan, critics of the system are concerned primarily with its financial health. According to NPR, in 2008, Taiwan spent about 6.23% of GDP on healthcare, compared to 16% in the U.S., and that is not enough to cover all the services provided. Since the premium for the national plan is set by the government, raising premiums were accompanied by voter backlash. Other problems include working conditions for doctors and healthcare professionals and overcrowding in hospitals brought on by cheaper access to healthcare and a price cap on medical services. As a side note, Dr. Ye is the first former cabinet-level official of Taiwan to testify at a U.S. congressional hearing. Pig farmers protested the latest proposal by the Council of Agriculture, COA, to increase pork imports by 3,000 tons by lowering the tariff from 12.5% to 6.25%. Pork prices reached an all-time high of NT$83.6 per kilogram, or USD $1.25 per pound, earlier this month from the average of NT$75 per kilogram, as a large number of piglets died from contracting porcini epidemic diarrhea, PED, an epidemic that has reportedly killed 22,000 pigs since last October. The COA hopes the new measure will curb the soaring prices and satisfy the supply shortage, as pork remains the main protein in Taiwan's diet. According to statistics, pork is accounted for nearly 50% of meat consumption in the country. While the deputy minister, Tim Wenda, claimed that Pig farmers are withholding sales as they expect the price to continue to rise. Farmers accuse the council of insensitivity and urge the government to stop manipulating pork prices. Representatives of farmers' associations explained that the cost of animal feed has skyrocketed in the past few years. The price of field corn, the main ingredient in the feed, has gone from NT$4 per Taiwan caddy to NT$13. It has been exceedingly difficult for them to survive in the domestic farming industry, especially during the outbreak of the epidemic. Yet the government continues to control the price, leaving them to live on meager profits at best. During recent years, pork price has been under government monitor, resulting in lower prices compared to other Asian countries. Amidst growing feed costs, pork price has been controlled at NT$5,000 to NT$6,000 for every 60 kilograms, while in countries such as China, Japan, and Korea, it has gone as high as NT$10,000. The group also blamed the council of its slow reaction in dealing with the epidemic. As the PED is a virus that has mutated into new forms, piglets are generally vulnerable to it, having no antibody in their immune system. However, not enough vaccine was obtained by the COA in time to keep the virus from spreading further. Contradicting the COA's estimation, the Farmer Association claimed that at least 50,000 pigs have died rather than the official number of 22,000. India can finally expect to rival China's activities in Africa after finding Japan as their new ally. The consulting firm McKinsey & Co. released a report last Monday predicting that India could quadruple its revenues from Africa to $160 billion by 2025. The report also suggests that India develop a strong presence in sectors that it has a unique value proposition. Forming an alliance with Japan will allow India to access capital at a lower cost, according to Noel Tata, chairman of the Africa Committee at Confederation of Indian Industry. Indian companies need cheaper funds to expand in Africa. Countries like Japan offer an ideal condition for them. We believe India's strengths and experiences of operating in similar capital-constrained conditions will be of great value to Africa, said Tata in an interview with Business Standard. Africa needs constructive foreign investment and holds the promise of long-term business for India. Traditionally, India and Japan have been helping to train African laborers to take up more jobs, while Chinese companies are often criticized for importing their workers to Africa. India and Japan have been planning a potential partnership in Africa for 4 years, but it only gathered momentum since Shinzo Abe became Japan's prime minister. According to Business Today, the two countries will first finalize their alliance to jointly bid for natural gas, as both countries are top gas import countries. McKinsey's report suggests that funding from low-cost countries like Japan can allow India to work on large projects. The report also predicts that India can aspire to capture almost 7% of the IT services market, 5% of the FMCG space, 10% of the power sector, and 2-5% of the agri-allied services businesses in Africa. In a partnership of equals, Indian industry could build relationships with African governments and businesses, identify opportunities through sector and country studies, develop an open consortium of interested companies in advance, said Barnik Chitran Mitra, a partner at McKinsey. Experts like Rajat Gupta from McKinsey acknowledges India's need to align with Japan. At the same time, they still can't openly recognize it as a counterweight to the growing Chinese influence in the continent.
For Alethea, this is Chaitin Ye and Jonathan Lee. You have been listening to The Debrief on the Katagala Media. Find us on www.katagalamedia.com or find us on Facebook and iTunes by searching for The Katagala Media. That's Ketagalan. Thanks for listening and tune in next time.